the end of chapter 1, which we got to yesterday, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yesterday. We were looking, and in your outline we have there the revelation of God's wrath, and then the revelation of God's person, and the revelation of man's rebellion. And we summarized that last time we got together. And there's a phrase that comes up a lot in those verses. It comes up three times. God gave them up. And we mentioned that that means that he abandoned them to their own ways. God gave them up. He abandoned them to their own ways. And it was going to result in them falling even further into their separation from God. And you'll notice in those three things, and in summary, if you go back to verse 24, it says, "Wherefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts." Notice that it begins with the heart. And you find there that he gave them up to their hearts, and then it says the body, that their bodies should be dishonored among themselves. And then, verse 26, the specific things that their body got involved with because their heart was affected, this caused God gave them up unto vile passions. So we know that what happened in the heart had its effect not only inside them, but on the outside. It happened as it affected them physically, morally, in turn of their heart, it affected them physically. So God gave them up in their bodies, and also in verse, you'll find in verse 28, in their mind. Even as they refused to have God in their knowledge, God gave them up unto a reprobate mind. When it says in verse 28, even as they refuse to have God in their knowledge, what's he indicating very, very clearly? What is Paul really indicating when he says they refuse to have God in their knowledge? What do we know that this chapter has told us about man? Man knows God, but has deliberately... Yes. Okay, they didn't acknowledge him, so... Right, they didn't acknowledge him as God. They refused to have him in their knowledge, and therefore God gave them up unto a reprobate mind. What's a reprobate mind? What's a... Yes? All right, it's a perverted mind, depraved mind. And, yes? Unnatural mind, and how can we put that into another phrase or another terminology?
Incorrigible.
Okay.
Condemned mind.
A condemned mind. It's a mind, in actual fact, that has been tested and found to be lacking, in fact, no good. It's found to be no good. God gave them up unto a mind which was their own. It was a mind which they had determined, and therefore God tested it because he gave them knowledge, and they rejected God, they refused to have him, so God gave him up unto that kind of mind. And we find that that is the final step as far as man is concerned as to where he has gone, and to a tested and found, a mind that's tested and found to be no good. There was one other verse which we didn't look at, and it's found in verse, it's the last verse of this chapter. Who, knowing the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them. You'll realize that we mentioned some of the specific things that man had got into, and it lists them for us in 26 and through verse 27, then into 28. It tells us about specific things that man, because he has rebelled against God, he has rejected God, those things that he has got into. And then it tells us in verse 32 once again that he knew about God, who, knowing the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them. Would you like to unravel, anybody like to unravel the meaning of that verse? Describing somebody who is now given up by God to do those things which are totally contrary to God, ungodliness and unrighteousness, sins that are specifically mentioned, then it tells us that they that practice such things are worthy of death, and they know it, but they're doing it anyway. What else does this person who has gone that far, who's practicing them, who knows that the result is death, what else is he doing? Yes, Pam?
They know we sin, and sin, and sin, and so it's really bad. But they take pleasure in other people's sin.
They take pleasure in other people's sin, all right, yes. All right, so they encourage, in other words, as God says, they encourage other people to do it, even though they know what is the result of the practice of these things.
Yeah.
That death is the practice of these things. Even then, they continue to do it and to encourage others to do it. Exactly. So we have a slight problem, don't we? In fact, it tells us there, who, knowing the ordinance of God, practice such things and consent. So they, knowing the ordinance of God, they practice them, and then they consent. So you have knowing, practicing, and consenting that others do it. And that really sums up the aspect of chapter 1, that man has fallen a long way. That man has fallen a long way. We see the regression that takes place as far as man is concerned in his relationship to God. What's the easiest to answer? Where are you? Or what are you doing in the kitchen with your hand in the cookie jar, ready to eat cookies with already some cookies in your mouth? Which is the easiest question to answer? Where are you? I think in terms of my own experience. When at home, I hear the voice of my mother or who it might be, Mark, where are you? And what's my answer going to be? Is it easy to answer that question, or is it easy to answer the question, what are you doing in the kitchen with your hand in the cookie jar and cookies in your mouth? Which is the easiest to answer?
Where are you?
Where are you? Why?
Here.
Right here. I'm just downstairs, or I'm somewhere, but you really don't need to know because I don't want you to know. This is what, in my mind, runs through, because what do I want to do once again?
Cover up
and therefore justify that which I know to be wrong. Now, in the book of Romans chapter 1, we see that what took place in the garden was man falling to the promptings of Satan. And God comes along and asks him that embarrassing question. Was it as if God didn't know? Did God know where Adam was? Sure, he knew where Adam was. And what did he say? What did Adam actually say in the garden? Remember?
What did Adam say?
Yeah.
Here, behind, we are hidden because we are naked.
We're hiding because we are naked. We are exposed. Adam knew exactly what God knew. And in chapter 1, it is necessary that man come to the understanding as to where he is, but not only where he is, but why he is where he is. And we know where he is. He's fallen. He's regressed. He's down. And it's important he understands how he got there. And so Paul has given to us in chapter 1 an explanation of how he got where he is. How man got where he is, hasn't he? And in our summary the last time, we discovered that. He's rejected God because he rebelled against God, and now he has repressed the truth. He's repressing what he knows, and he knows God. God has been revealed to him. We've given one express way, and that was the revelation of creation. All right? If we've come to look at this chapter, and perhaps this is a way we can pattern Bible study. And I was encouraged in this being shared with me, and possibly this is a good way to approach our Bible study. We take a passage and we summarize it. And we did our summary just a little bit late. But the idea is to summarize your passage and then outline it, which we've got. We get a key idea of what the whole passage is about. Then we've outlined it as we have here. Then thirdly, after outlining it, you interpret it. You try to find a little more of the meaning that is being explained in all the verses. Having done that, then you determine the principles that are given in a passage. Then having obviously got the principles, we'll know we can make our personal application. So if so far we've looked at chapter 1 and said, right, this is what it's about. We've said there's been an introduction to Paul, to the Son of God, to the saints at Rome. We've seen that there's a prayer of Paul. Then predominantly what Paul is getting at in that chapter is what? Sin in the world.
A need for Christ.
Okay, how would we any other way of summarizing? Rejection of God. What other way would you summarize it? In your own terms, just as you've thought through now, chapter 1, how would you summarize those verses, particularly 18 to the end? Just for something to latch on to as you look through the whole of the text, because it's good to do this for each chapter. Hopelessness of man, all right? What other way? Yeah?
Foolishness of man.
Condemnation of those who reject God.
All right, then we summarize it, we outline it, and we've got that before us, and then we interpret some of the meaning there. What principles can we get or glean from chapter 1? First of all, and if you want to make a note, just a few of these. We can say this, that men are under the wrath of God because they've disobeyed the light they've received. The light they have. Men are under the wrath of God because they've disobeyed the light they've received. Them being given certain light. And what do we know the light to be that God gave to man? To explain himself, to show himself. What was it? Yes, Janet? The awareness of God in creation, his power and his deity. Remember? Those two things. So, men are under the wrath of God because they've disobeyed the light they have. They rejected that which God showed to them. And he showed them himself, his deity, and his power through creation. And chapter 1 tells us that he brings his wrath upon them because of the rejection of that. That's the first thing. Secondly, another principle we can gain from this is, what message must we preach to mankind? According to chapter 1. Don't go too far into the book. First of all, what must people know about? We are sinners. What else? Yes? Okay, that's another one. They have no excuse. What else? They have no excuse and they are sinners, but that means beans to no one if God's what? Yes?
Therefore I'm not ashamed.
Right. That's true, but what I'm getting at is this. If you know you have no excuse, if you know you're a sinner, but so what? So what if I have no excuse? So what if I am a sinner? Yes. God's judgment. God's wrath. Man must know of God's anger, God's wrath, God's righteousness against the sin of man. So the judgment of God. We must preach the wrath of God. It's an essential portion of the gospel, isn't it? And that we must reckon with a righteous God. He must be seen as to who he is, that he is a righteous God. Another thing we have is this. And in the progression of what we saw in chapter 1, we've seen God, from the worship of God to idolatry. And what was the third one? From God to idolatry to immorality. Right. Went to immorality. And then we find that a man who has himself at the center of his life instead of God is really foolish. He's in a position which is really intellectually indefensible. Even a person who has himself at the center of his life, he's come to a foolish place. He's foolish. and man needs to know that. And then one other thing, what is the essence of sin from chapter 1? What is really the real core of sin that we've talked about it? What's the core of all sin?
Self.
Self what though? Well, that will be the result, isn't it? In a sense, self-centeredness. Remember we said that godliness is God-centeredness, but sin, the essence of it, is self-centeredness. That which was caused when Satan said to Adam, you can be like God. You can be gods.
Is that like not giving honor to God?
Right. That's what produces it, isn't it? Not giving honor to God as to who he is, and then not thanking God. All right. What personal application can we make? We're going through this, and we won't do it every time, because the idea will be for you to draw them, or you to share with me. But this time, share with me yourselves, what personal application then can you make for you in those truths that we've gained as we've gone through chapter 1? What personal application can we make? Jackie.
That I know that I really need God. I can't do anything on my own. I'm just not worth the time.
All right. I need God. Good. Ray, any personal application you can find from chapter 1?
Basically, you're nothing without God. You're incomplete.
We're incomplete without God. Good. Anything else? Yes.
Just be aware of the wrath of God, that even though he's a God of love, he does judge sin.
Good. To be aware of the wrath of God. We too need to be aware of the wrath of God. Yes, sir.
To know that I am capable of every one of these things that's been listed, if I don't have God in the center of my life, when we think of the depths that we can fall to, each one
is right. Just think in terms of what Pat has just said. Think in terms of what man can get to without God. Or rather, should I say this, what man can do with God. Do you have God in your life by Jesus Christ this morning? To what depths can you go, even as a person with Christ? What has happened even within a week in your mind here? And in my mind, to what depths can we go with God? Does that scare you a little bit? I think it's really something that we who are Christians can still be doing some of the things that we've been doing for a long time. But it shows us what we really are. But just think of what man is like without God, when he hasn't got God. And this is something we can see the horror of what sin has done to mankind, and it's described in those verses. All right, we need to begin chapter 2, but it's worth just seeing the pattern that we can establish for our study here. Get in a moment, where we look at the text and we summarize it. Oh, that's about this, and we give it a word. And then we outline it and say, right, we can see some established thoughts that Paul is laying down in this letter. And then we interpret those thoughts, and then we take principles from it and see what application we can make. Yes?
One thing that I found in reading this chapter that's been very important to me is I have often found in witnessing that people say, well, what about the people in the jungle or something who've never heard of God? How dare God even try and condemn them? And it says right here why and for what reasons, and that they can know God when many times before, you know, they could really try to back me up into a corner. So they were almost saying, you know, how dare you try to tell me about God? I'd be okay if you just would keep God out of my life.
Right, that's good. That's a tremendous conclusion to come to. It's a hard one to come to. But people say, well, don't go to the jungles and tell people about Christ. Because if you tell them about Christ and they reject Christ, then what?
They're lost.
But what's this saying?
They're lost
without rejecting Christ, but because they've rejected the light that they have already been given. Is there anybody who's responded to the light that they've been given? Has anybody responded to creation? We know Christ has, but any man, any sinful man, he's lost because he is a sinner. Now, this can get us tied up, obviously, but we've had an observation which is very important. Some say, hey, don't tell people who've never heard of Christ about Christ, because you get them destined to hell if you tell them and they reject. No, they're already lost. Man is already lost. He's in the condition of sin. So God wants to restore them. He wants to get them out of that. And that's why the gospel Paul is saying is being preached. Okay? Good. Chapter 2. And you'll see in your outline, and obviously you've not got a full outline here, you have, secondly, the self-righteous or moralist condemned. The self-righteous or moralist condemned. Chapter 2, verse 1 through 16. And I think the only thing you have there is, first of all, the judgment of man, right? Judgment of man. Let's try and determine, to whom is Paul talking in chapter 2? Paul. I think he's behind Kathy from Dallas. Yeah, who's he talking to when we think of a moralist or a self-righteous person?
I don't know what a moralist is.
Okay, let's try. That's what we want to find out then. Who is a self-righteous person? What kind of person is a self-righteous person? Okay, Charlie?
One who judges and condemns another.
One who judges and condemns another. All right.
Or thinks himself better than someone else.
All right, that's getting to be a little closer, isn't it? Where you think you are better, you are living up to your own standard. Somebody who is living up to his own standard. Well, who says he's living up to his own standard, but he's not. Mark, what are you going to say something?
Well, it's just that he earns his righteousness through works.
All right, he can earn his righteousness through works. In fact, I would be a little wrong in saying that he lives up to his own standard. The problem with the self-righteous person is that he thinks he's living up to his own standard, but he's not. And that's where the moralist, the one who thinks by being moral, he can be satisfying to God. And he's trying to be moral, but he can't be moral. He is self-righteous, saying, I'm good enough. And yet when you see his life, and you're able to look into his heart as God can, we know that he is not righteous. He's not moral. Yes?
Isn't the neck here holier than thou? Isn't that expression just that feeling of...
Yes, can be. Right. But somebody... doesn't necessarily have to have that feeling. In this particular chapter, I'd say, yes, he's that way inclined. That he's saying, I'm holier than thou. Yet I'm doing some of the things that you're doing, but I'm still better than you are. Right. Yes, Mark?
I think he's talking to the Jewish Romans.
All right. When we come down to specifically the group of people, it's possible that the predominant group of this part of this church that Paul is talking to are Jewish, because they were the ones who had a revealed law. But we can't say that chapter 2 completely, or these first 16 verses, just deal with the Jew. There are those who are non-Jews who also can be self-righteous or moralists, who say that they can be right with God on their own moral abilities or tries, if you like. So probably most of them are Jews, but there are those who are non-Jews too.
He says you,
yeah. Yeah, he does. He says, wherefore thou art without excuse, O man. But then in verse 7 he says, but if thou bearest the name of a Jew. So, as I say, the clearer way of putting it is that he's speaking to a greater group of people, but probably predominantly Jewish. Right? In summary, let's say this. This moralist, this self-righteous person, makes judgments about others. He makes judgments about others, indicating that he does know the difference between right and wrong. If he makes a judgment about something, he knows the difference between right and wrong, doesn't he? And yet, he breaks his own moral code. All right, so that would be maybe a summary. I'll give it to you again. This moralist or self-righteous person, he makes judgments about others, reveals a knowledge of right and wrong, but breaks his own moral code. He breaks his own standard. Okay, those three things maybe we can think of. First of all, he makes judgments about others. He knows between right and wrong, and he breaks his own moral code. It's Paul, as if he's standing there and saying, these people, and referring to chapter 1, look what they're like, look what they're doing. They're fallen in sin, and there's somebody standing by him as a self-righteous person, a moralist, and what's he saying? Amen. Amen. Preach that. He's useless. He's worthless. What does Paul do? Turns to him and says, you're just the same. What happens to this man who's standing by Paul? He goes, me? Surely you can't be talking about me. But I'm... That's the man who's the moralist. He said amen, but really inside, what's he doing? Basically the same thing. And this is how we'll look at it. First of all, this man has tried to justify himself. He's self-justifying. Reading in verse 1, wherefore thou art without excuse, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. Now there are two ways of judging, aren't there? Is it wrong to judge? Is it wrong to judge? We don't have to judge. We have to judge. In what way, Charlie?
We have to judge who we will spend time with.
Okay. And what are you doing then when you judge in that particular way?
Well, we're told to separate ourselves and we're not to be involved with people who have a poor reputation.
Okay. So is it wrong for me to say to you, when I see you do something which is contrary to the word, is it wrong for me to say, that's wrong? One person would say no. Is it wrong for me to tell you when you're doing something wrong?
Depends if you do it also.
Okay. There's a difference there, isn't it? I'm probably not likely, knowing myself... No, I can't say that. I would tell you, even though I'm doing it myself, because I know my own heart.
But you have to go a little further and say, if you do it in love...
Yes. Well, I don't have to do it in love. I don't have to do it in love, but it would be wise to do it in love.
Even if you did it wrong, then.
Yes.
If you did it throughout, then it would be okay.
Yes, I can come to you and say, I've been doing this all the time for the last 10 years, but you, don't do it. I could do that. Yes.
Then what do you do about that verse that says to get the law that you're on?
Right. This is the point here. But the idea is that we have to. There are two kinds of judgment. One is this. And we say that... We condemn somebody else. By judgment, we're condemning somebody else. We say, that is wrong, and we condemn them. But there's another form of judgment, and this is what we're talking about, which is good. And we have to come to judgment. We have to be able to say that that is wrong. And I think we have the right as Christians to say when somebody is doing something wrong. And it's this, the faculty of moral discrimination, the ability to determine what is right and wrong. That's judging. We have to be able to judge between right and wrong. We have to be able to discern between right and wrong. When I see you doing something wrong, I have to discern that it's wrong. I have to understand that it's wrong. Right? Now, there's nothing wrong, actually, with that kind of judging if it's coming from a pure heart. God does it. He judges from a pure heart. My problem is that what do I do when I judge? I'm an offender and I condemn you for it and you condemn me for it. All right, this person here, what is he doing? He's condemning somebody else for doing something that he is also practicing himself without any qualms at all. So he stands up saying, I'm all right, but you're not. Don't do it. Can you illustrate this from the scriptures at all? Okay. So what did he do?
He wanted the money from this guy. And And he wanted this guy thrown in jail for not paying him the money, but then he owed the other guy some.
So he asked him to forgive him, right?
Right.
Let him go. As soon as he got forgiveness, he went and wrung the guy's neck to try and make him pay. Good. There's one other illustration that I don't think of yet.
David,
what did David do? He coveted, he lusted, he took somebody for himself, somebody else's wife, somebody else who had only one wife, and he had how many wives? Several. Then what did he do? He had the chief take the man, the woman's husband, Bathsheba's husband, and do what to him? Have him killed in battle and cover the whole thing up. So he coveted and lusted. He committed adultery and he murdered and he lied. What did Nathan do when he came along? David, I've got something to tell you. There's a man and he has some sheep. Some nice sheep. And there's another man and he's poor and he only has one. And this one man has taken. He's literally stolen it from this poor man. This ewe, this lamb, he's taken it away from him. This rich man who has so much. What did David do? Boy, he got angry and said, show me that man. What did Nathan say? You are that man. What happened to David? Did he get the message? He got the message, didn't he? He got the message. And I believe we are to get the message. He said, show me that man. Now there's the self-righteous. David had done exactly the same and Nathan was making the point. And right here, Paul is saying, do you get the message? Do you get the message? You have condemned by your judgment, even though you can have the faculty to discern between right and wrong and be quite correct in your judgment. But what you're doing, you self-righteous moralist, you're saying you are wrong. And yet you're practicing exactly the same thing that you're condemning somebody for doing. So you self-justify and then you self-condemn. That's what verse 1 is saying. Wherefore thou art without excuse. You too, you man, whoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest dost practice the same things. The same things. This man is practicing the same things. Now, I don't think Paul is necessarily saying that he's the one who's actually committed acts of homosexuality or necessarily he's bowed down to a piece of wood. No, but in the heart, he's practicing the same things. Covetousness, yes. Backbiting, yes. Envy, yes. Haughtiness, yes. Insolent, yes. Disobedient parents, yes. This man is condemning other people and yet saying, I should be accepted by God. I'm good enough for God. And Paul says, now wait a minute. You're condemning yourself by your accusation in actual fact. Why? Now, it's not because he's doing these things that he's condemned. Why is this man actually condemned? Because the judgment is according to truth, yes. Why is this man condemned? Yes.
Because by accusing others, he is understanding the difference between right and wrong.
Right.
He himself is guilty.
So right. Good. He does know the difference between right and wrong, doesn't he? And so therefore, he's judged for that. Now, he's judged because, well, what is it, in fact, actually he's saying? He's saying, don't do things, and yet he does them. The other man in chapter 1 is saying, I don't care. I'll do them anyway. This one in chapter 2 is saying, you shouldn't do these, and practices them. In chapter 1, the man's saying, well, I don't care. I can do them if I want to. Does it make sense? You've got the two different kinds there. Yes, Tom?
First of all, you know, our own offenses look the worst on somebody else. Those are the ones that offend us the most.
And I think Paul's kind of pointing this out, that be very careful if you're really offended by somebody, that's not a reflection of the log in your own eye. And the other thing isn't sometimes the moralist deal a spiritual, like he's committed spiritual adultery by going after other gods, and maybe not physical adultery, but there's a physical manifest. Paul's pointed out the physical manifestation of spiritual sins.
Mm-hmm.
And God's going to judge him spiritually. You've slandered me, you've libeled my name, you've got everywhere you've gone, people have blaspheme me because of you. Isn't he some way pointing towards that?
Yes, all of them will be judged spiritually. The manifestation is a little different, yes. But the roots are the same. Yeah. Well, we're going to get the whole morning behind, so we better stop there. What I want you to do for tomorrow is read chapter 2. I want you to find out, if this is the judgment of man, how he judges, I want you to find out in what areas God judges. All right? How does God judge? And there are specifically three I want you to try and find. How does God judge? Man judges according to his own self-righteous ways, and in so doing he judges himself. He condemns himself, this righteous, particularly the self-righteous moralist. So let's look for the means whereby God judges. Okay? Let's close in a word of prayer.